And our first speaker is Dr. Larry Goldstein, Professor of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at UC San Diego Medical Center, a Howard Hughes investigator, a leader of the stem cell community in San Diego, and as you heard this morning, a founder of the Sanford Consortium for Regenerative Medicine.
So Floyd just gave you the bad news about the set of disorders that we'll talk about, and I'm not going to make it any better at the beginning, but hopefully we'll end on a hopeful note towards the end. And the specific problem I'll talk about is Alzheimer's disease, which is well known, basically no disease-modifying drugs. The disorder is incredibly common, 50% of us over 85, 10% of us over 65, with an aggregate emotional and financial cost that is really substantial. In a descriptive sense, we've known what this disorder looks like for some time. It starts with synapse loss in the brain, ultimately leading to neuronal death. The cause is largely mysterious, with a few hereditary forms known, but the disease is primarily sporadic, as I'll come back to in a moment. And the dominant hypothesis, as you know, for the mechanism of disease is largely based on the pathology, which has proposed in the so-called amyloid cascade hypothesis that proteins or peptides in the so-called amyloid plaques are sufficient to drive a series of biochemical changes, ultimately leading to neurofibrillary tangles, synapse loss, and neuronal death. Now, what I'll share with you in the first few minutes of this talk is some of the reasons why I've come to believe that this hypothesis is probably wrong or at the very least incomplete, and then why we are having some limitations in our ability to test this in animal models, and then what we're trying to do using human stem cell technology to make progress on this very terrible disorder. So, as background, I just want to remind you that neurons are the most polarized cells in the body, as well as being the largest cells in the body. So your typical neuron is diagrammed here with a cell body, which is, in a sense, the factory of the cell where proteins and organelles are made. And then in order for the synapse to function properly, these materials are ferried out along microtubule tracts to the synapse where they can do their job. And there's a large number of materials that are made in the cell body and sent out to the synapse, and these are driven by so-called molecular motors, kinesins in particular, and then there are retrograde, backward pathways that come from synapse back to cell body, and these are primarily recycling pathways as well as neurotrophic signaling pathways, which is very important. So, for example, in the basal forebrain, nerve growth factor that's released in the cortex is endocytosed by basal forebrain cholinergic neurons, and then that activated signaling complex is physically moved back to cell bodies. And as I'll mention in a moment, that process appears to be defective in this disorder and may be a very important piece of it. Now, you don't like my pointer? Oh, it's heartbroken. But I can't figure out how to use this one. All right. Okay. Is that better? Okay. Does that mean I get to start over, Floyd? So this is sort of the picture you find in most textbooks, including some that I think Floyd is co-author on. And this is wildly misleading in terms of the size problem that these cells face. And so I want to just give you a feel for how big a problem this is. So some of you may recognize this individual. This fellow is, believe it or not, the governor of California. I love California, I got to tell you. Anyway, so the Gov has a lot of problems beyond just the state budget. And the one in particular I want to focus on is that his peripheral nervous system has the problem of supporting synapses and synaptic firing in his toes, where the neurons have to talk to the muscles in the toes. And so these cells are amazing. The cell body, the factory, is located up in his spinal cord. I probably should have used a reverse view here. I'm going to have to get one of those. Anyway, and then this axon that sort of is the pipe through which materials have to be ferried is a meter in length, okay? It's remarkable. And the axon is on the order of 3 to 5 microns when it comes out of the cell body. So I like to do a scaling operation because most of you are probably not used to thinking in microns, and since most of you are Americans, you're not used to thinking in meters either. So it turns out that if you convert microns to feet to scale this, The cell body ends up being about 20 feet by 20 feet. So maybe a quarter or third the size of this room would be the cell body. The axon, when it leaves the side of the cell body, is a pipe about anywhere from 1 to 5 feet in diameter. And then if you scale the axon by that same micron to foot conversion over a meter, what you end up with is that the cell body in this room here in La Jolla has to go through this 200-mile-long axon to support the synapse located in Bakersfield. Okay? It's remarkable. It takes on the order of 1 to 10 days to get there. And I want you to notice that the journey is fraught with peril. There is the opportunity for many kinds of accidents along the way. You might run out of water or gas or what have you. And this is actually important in thinking about these cells. They're enormously susceptible to environmental damage. And now this is an extreme example, of course, in the peripheral nervous system. But if you were to cut a hole in Arnold's brain and look, for example, at his basal forebrain cholinergic neurons, my favorite kind of neuron, they often have axons on the length of centimeters. And so, you know, they've got to get up to Oceanside or Irvine. So it's still a very substantial problem. Okay, so that's the background. Now, because these pathways are so long and the pipes are so thin, not only are they sensitive to external disturbance, they're sensitive to internal disturbance. And you may know that many neurodegenerative disorders have as part of their pathogenesis the accumulation of aggregated proteins. And so we've been able to do some simple experiments over the years, and I want to illustrate one for you, again, just to put you in the mood here. So what we've done here is we've tagged a membrane protein in vesicles with YFP, and we've driven its expression in single fruit fly neurons in filleted fruit fly larvae. And you can see these little vesicular packages moving around. And this process is very interesting for reasons I won't have time to discuss with you. But what's interesting is that in the video clip below, what we've done is to express a polyglutamine protein in the cytosol of these neurons. And you can see that you generate these big blobs. If you stained with a polyglutamine antibody, you'd see it there. And it physically blocks as well as depresses overall traffic. And for a variety of reasons, we've come to think that this sort of disturbance in these long-distance movement pathways happen very early in many different neurodegenerative diseases and may be particularly important in the pathogenesis of Alzheimer's disease. Now, Alzheimer's disease itself, you probably recall, revolves around the behavior of this protein, the amyloid precursor protein, from which proteolysis releases this little pink peptide that can aggregate into the amyloid plaques that are part of the characteristic pathology in the brains of such individuals. But of course, this peptide comes from a much larger precursor protein. Now, in humans, mutations in the gene encoding this protein, or mutations in one of the genes that encodes one of the proteases involved in processing this protein, can lead to rare forms of hereditary Alzheimer's disease, terribly virulent forms of the disease that lead to dementia even in the 30s of these individuals, and in fact, extra copies of the gene encoding this protein in humans, as is found in Down syndrome or in some familial duplications of the gene, also lead to early onset hereditary disease. So in essence, almost all Down's patients have Alzheimer's disease, as if there weren't enough problems already, and it's relatively early onset. Now, this protein is one that is actively synthesized in neuronal cell bodies and then moved out to synapses in a process that requires the molecular motor proteins that I just mentioned. And what's become very interesting to us is that if you make too much of this protein in animal models, it poisons the movement machinery, so that the movement of these vesicles and others are in many cases disturbed. Now, a long series of experiments from us and from others have suggested that part of what may be going on in this axonal transport disturbance reflects the ability of the molecular motor protein shown here, conventional kinesin, to form a ternary or binary complex with the APP, amyloid precursor protein itself. And we think that that's part of what may be going wrong when you make too much of this guy. It poisons this machinery. And in fact, it turns out that for many years, for decades in fact, it's been known that late in the course of disease, that movement machinery is disturbed, that long-distance nerve growth factor signaling in the basal forebrain is aberrant. And in fact, in more recent studies from us and others, it's become apparent that pretty much every gene and gene product that's been implicated in Alzheimer's disease, when overexpressed or expressed in mutant forms, poisons the transport machinery in a variety of different ways in both fruit fly models and mouse models. And we think that this is pretty interesting. I'll show you one example here where in the mouse basal forebrain cholinergic system, you can see that there's a typical basal forebrain cholinergic axon in EM. Here's one that in which large amounts of APP have been made, and you can see that these axons fill with stalled vesicles and organelles that distend the axon and appear to physically block movement. This and a number of other observations over the years are summarized here, where, namely, too much APP poisons transport, poisons nerve growth factor signaling from hippocampus to basal forebrain. This is work we've done with Bill Mobley. And interestingly, all of these are independent of that so-called toxic amyloid beta peptide that's generated from the amyloid precursor protein. That is, they're non-amyloid-dependent phenotypes. If you reduce presenilin or make too much of some of the familial mutants, these also not only decrease APP transport in axons. What's really interesting is recently we found that they actually stimulate that backward pathway, and we think that maybe that may be part of a damage response of some sort. And then if you reduce levels of kinesin or overexpress the other protease, again, you get similar patterns of behavior with decreased transport, reduced numbers of synapses, as well as activation of damage signaling pathways, and for those of you who really follow this field, increases in tau phosphorylation, which in animal models may be a signal that something in this pathway is being induced. Okay. And you can even propose a model based on this, which in my view is my favorite alternative to the amyloid cascade model. And I won't drag you through the details. Now here's the ultimate problem, okay? And this is what I've sort of set you up for. We have my favorite hypothesis. We have the field's favorite hypothesis. And then there's at least 10 or 20 other hypotheses floating around out there for what's going on in the disease, which pathways may be important, what happens at the beginning, what happens at the end. And if you get a bunch of neuroscientists in a room and you say what your favorite hypothesis is, it'll usually provoke a fight. So since you're not neuroscientists, I think I'm going to get away with this for a moment. But here's the real core problem. The bulk of the work has been done on animal models of Alzheimer's disease. Okay? And the bad news is the animals don't actually get Alzheimer's disease. They have some of the pathologies, but not all of them. And they don't have massive neuronal loss. And I mean, who can tell if a mouse is demented anyway? So the problem you have, or a fruit fly for that matter, so the problem you have is how are you going to resolve among these hypotheses, and then how are you going to test and develop drugs if the animal models really aren't very good, in my view? So, this is where human ES technology, you can do human neuropathology and you can find similar things in the human. I'll skip through this. But again, it's all post hoc. It's after people have died, you're looking at their brains. Okay, so this is where we've turned in the past few years to the development of human Alzheimer models in a dish. This was started by Nicole Kimes and Tomas Falzoni in my lab. And the idea is really simple. You've heard it all morning. If you can make human neurons in a dish, some of which carry hereditary mutations, some of which don't, and some of which have other genetic modifications of pathways that you think may play into this, you may be able to test these ideas. And so we've been spending the past couple of years generating genetic lines, genetically manipulated lines, as well as assays for trying to sort through this. One example of what we've been able to do, at least on good days with these cells, is in work from a student of mine, Emily Davis, in collaboration with a bioengineer at Irvine, Newly June. We've been able to adapt these cells so that they'll grow and generate neurons in a culture system in which we can plate the cell bodies in a lithography-generated chamber on one side, and then there are little grooves that are 5 microns in diameter that go through to another chamber. And so the neurons will extend their axons through, and this gives you biochemical access to the two parts of the cell independently, which is important for testing some of these ideas, it turns out. And this is an example of, you know, the representative best image where, for example, with MAP2 or a nuclear stain DAPI, you can see that the somatodendritic compartment of these cells is confined to one end of this chamber. You can see the axons growing through these grooves, and then you see this florid overgrowth of the axons when they get to the other side. They'll generate axons that are a millimeter or two in length. It's really quite remarkable. And so we're trying to bring this into hypothesis testing regimes now. The other thing we've been able to do is to begin, and this is initially the work of Rhiannon and Nolan, begin knocking down the expression of kinesin genes and other genes that we think are relevant to these pathways and begin testing some of our ideas about will transport reduction directly begin generating the biochemical changes in these neurons that we think are characteristic of disease. And so Rhiannon has started working on this, and given the time, I'm not going to show you each of these gel bands in detail. Suffice it to say, we think that we're seeing some of the same kinds of biochemical changes that we've discovered in animal models. And then finally, since one of the things we're most interested in is tracking the behavior of moving organelles and vesicles in this system, recently Tomas Falzoni did a very nice experiment where using, again, in vitro generated human neurons from human ES lines. He was able to make this nice little movie of moving mitochondria in one of these human neurons in a dish, which is the sort of assay we're beginning to bring to bear now to start studying these mutations that we're generating. And Shauna Yuan, who I think has a poster out here, hopefully can fill you in on the work she's doing to try to generate presenilin-1 mutations in these human cells. And I'll skip through the cholesterol part. Okay, now the other part of the issue, of course, is that 99% of Alzheimer's disease in humans is sporadic, which is code for we don't know what caused it, except we know that it's got a large genetic contribution. Perhaps 50% or more of the risk comes from genetics. And so the question is how to get a handle on that. And so we've been working to make human pluripotent iPS lines from people afflicted with sporadic disease. And this has been the work of a student in my lab, Mason Israel, working in collaboration with the UCSD Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, which is doing what Ken suggested is an important thing a few minutes ago, which is to actually track the patients, follow them cognitively, as well as get autopsy material upon their demise. And so we've been collecting now fibroblasts, skin biopsies, and then growing fibroblasts out from all of these patients. We get their MMSE data and their APOE genotypes, for those of you who follow this. And then thus far, Mason has been able to generate from, I guess now, four or five patients what look to be iPS lines from each of these 80 to 85-year-old people. The lines that he's been generating have typical characteristics of pluripotent lines. There you see in a couple of controls, NANOG, OCT, and TRA. Same for some AD samples. And then these guys retain at least the normal karyotypes, as well as happily at least the same karyotype at the sex chromosome, so we're pretty sure we didn't get that the samples mixed up. That's good. And then in experiments where we can directly induce differentiation of neurons in culture systems, all of these different lines seem to be quite capable of generating neurons that anecdotally at least appear to be better in quality than what we generate from true human ES lines. So the interesting experience anecdotally, no real rigorous data to support this, is that you know, 85-year-old skin samples, well, the skin is 85, the sample's not, not only do very well in growing out fibroblasts, but actually seem to reprogram pretty nicely and generate neurons in culture. So you can sort of see the kinds of things we want to begin doing with these. These are some of the folks who've done the work. I've tried to cite them as I've gone through, in particular Mason on the reprogram stuff. And Mason has, where is Mason? Where are you? He's right up there hiding. Okay, he's going to have a poster out there. So you should go look at his poster and ask him questions. And then a few other folks from my lab, Shauna Yuan, hopefully has one as well. So thank you.